The Two Towers, Disc 13.
It must have been a little after midnight when Gollum woke up. Suddenly they were aware of his pale eyes, unlidded, gleaming at them. He listened and sniffed, which seemed, as they had noticed before, his usual method of discovering the time of night.
"Are we rested? Have we had beautiful sleep?" he said. "Let's go."
"We aren't, and we haven't," growled Sam. "But we'll go if we must." Gollum dropped at once from the branches of the tree onto all fours, and the hobbits followed more slowly. As soon as they were down, they went on again with Gollum leading, eastwards, up the dark, sloping land. They could see little, for the night was now so deep that they were hardly aware of the stems of trees before they stumbled against them. The ground became more broken and walking was more difficult, but Gollum seemed in no way troubled. He led them through thickets and wastes of brambles, sometimes round the lip of a deep cleft or dark pit, sometimes down into black bush-shrouded hollows and out again. But if ever they went a little downward, always the further slope was longer and steeper. They were climbing steadily. At their first halt they looked back, and they could dimly perceive the roofs of the forest they had left behind, lying like a vast, dense shadow, a darker night under the dark, blank sky. There seemed to be a great blackness looming slowly out of the east, eating up the faint blurred stars. Later the sinking moon escaped from the pursuing cloud, but it was ringed all about with a sickly yellow glare. At last Gollum turned to the hobbits.
"Day soon," he said. "Hobbits must hurry. Not safe to stay in the open in these places. Make haste."
He quickened his pace, and they followed him wearily. Soon they began to climb up onto a great hogback of land. For the most part it was covered with a thick growth of gorse and whortleberry, and low, tough thorns, though here and there clearings opened, the scars of recent fires. The gorse bushes became more frequent as they got nearer the top. Very old and tall they were, gaunt and leggy below, but thick above, and already putting out yellow flowers that glimmered in the gloom and gave a faint, sweet scent. So tall were the spiny thickets that the hobbits could walk upright under them, passing through long, dry aisles carpeted with a deep, prickly mould. On the further edge of this broad hillback they stayed their march, and crawled for hiding, underneath a tangled knot of thorns. Then twisted boughs, stooping to the ground, were overridden by a clamouring maze of old briars. Deep inside there was a hollow hall, rafted with dead branch and bramble, and roofed with the first leaves and shoots of spring. There they lay for a while, too tired yet to eat, and peering out through the holes in the covert, they watched for the slow growth of day. But no day came, only a dead brown twilight. In the east there was a dull red glare under the lowering sky. It was not the red of dawn. Across the tumbled lands between, the mountains of the Ef-el-Duath frowned at them, black and shapeless below, where night lay thick and did not pass away. Above, with jagged tops and edges outlined hard and menacing against the fiery glow. Away to their right, a great shoulder of the mountain stood out, dark and black amid the shadows, thrusting westward. "Which way do we go from here?" asked Frodo. "Is that the opening of the Morgul Valley, away over there beyond that black mass?"
"Need we think about it yet?" said Sam. "Surely we're not going to move any more today, if day it is."
"Perhaps not, perhaps not," said Gollum. "But we must go soon to the crossroads. Yes, to the crossroads. That's the way over there. Yes, master."
The red glare over Mordor died away. The twilight deepened as great vapours rose in the east and crawled above them. Frodo and Sam took a little food and then lay down, but Gollum was restless. He wouldn't eat any of their food, but he drank a little water and then crawled about under the bushes, sniffing and muttering. Then suddenly he disappeared.
"Off hunting, I suppose," said Sam, and yawned. It was his turn to sleep first, and he was soon deep in a dream. He thought he was back in the Bag-End garden looking for something, but he had a heavy pack on his back, which made him stoop. It all seemed very weedy and rank somehow, and thorns and bracken were invading the beds down near the bottom edge.
"A job of work for me, I can see, but I'm so tired," he kept on saying. Presently he remembered what he was looking for. "My pipe," he said, and with that he woke up. "Silly," he said to himself, as he opened his eyes and wondered why he was lying down under the hedge. "It's in your pack all the time." Then he realized, first that the pipe might be in his pack, but he had no leaf, and next that he was hundreds of miles from Bag End. He sat up. It seemed to be almost dark. Why had his master let him sleep on out of turn, right on till evening?
"Haven't you had no sleep, Mr. Frodo?" he said. "What's the time?"
"Seems to be getting late."
"No, it isn't," said Frodo. "But the day is getting darker instead of lighter. Darker and darker. As far as I can tell, it isn't midday yet, and you've only slept for about 3 hours."
"I wonder what's up," said Sam. "Is there a storm coming? If so, it's going to be the worst there ever was. We shall wish we were down a deep hole, not just stuck under a hedge." He listened. "What's that? Thunder or drums, or what is it?"
"I don't know," said Frodo. "It's been going on for a good while now. Sometimes the ground seems to tremble. Sometimes it seems to be the heavy air throbbing in your ears."
Sam looked round. "Where's Gollum?" he said. "Hasn't he come back yet?"
"No," said Frodo. "There's not been a sign or sound of him."
"Well, I can't abide him," said Sam. "In fact, I've never taken anything on a journey that I'd have been less sorry to lose on the way. But it would be just like him, after coming all these miles, to go and get lost now, just when we shall need him most, that is, if he's ever going to be any use, which I doubt."
"You forget the marshes," said Frodo. "I hope nothing has happened to him. And I hope he's up to no tricks. And anyway, I hope he doesn't fall into other hands, as you might say, because if he does, we shall soon be in for trouble." At that moment a rolling and rumbling noise was heard again, louder now and deeper. The ground seemed to quiver under their feet. "I think we're in for trouble anyhow," said Frodo. "I'm afraid our journey is drawing to an end."
"Maybe," said Sam.
"But where there's life, there's hope, as my gaffer used to say, and need of victuals, as he most ways used to add.
You have a bite, Mr. Frodo, and then a bit of sleep."
The afternoon, as Sam supposed it must be called, wore on. Looking out from the covert, he could see only a dun, shadowless world, fading slowly into a featureless, colourless gloom. It felt stifling, but not warm. Frodo slept unquietly, turning and tossing, and sometimes murmuring. Twice Sam thought he heard him speaking Gandalf's name. The time seemed to drag interminably. Suddenly Sam heard a hiss behind him, and there was Gollum on all fours, peering at them with gleaming eyes.
"Wake up, wake up, wake up, sleepies," he whispered. "Wake up, no time to lose. We must go, yes, we must go at once. No time to lose."
Sam stared at him suspiciously. He seemed frightened or excited.
"Go now? What's your little game? It isn't time yet."
"It can't be tea time even, leastways not in decent places where there is tea time."
"Silly," hissed Gollum. "We're not in decent places. Time's running short, yes, running fast. No time to lose. We must go. Wake up, master, wake up."
He clawed at Frodo, and Frodo, startled out of sleep, sat up suddenly and seized him by the arm. Gollum tore himself loose and backed away.
"They mustn't be silly," he hissed. "We must go. No time to lose."
And nothing more could they get out of him. Where he had been, and what he thought was brewing to make him in such a hurry, he would not say. Sam was filled with deep suspicion, and showed it, but Frodo gave no sign of what was passing in his mind. He sighed, hoisted his pack, and prepared to go out into the ever-gathering darkness. Very stealthily Gollum led them down the hillside, keeping under cover wherever it was possible, and running, almost bent to the ground, across any open space. But the light was now so dim that even a keen-eyed beast of the wild could scarcely have seen the hobbits, hooded, in their grey cloaks, nor heard them, walking as warily as the little people can. Without the crack of a twig or the rustle of a leaf, they passed and vanished. For about an hour they went on, silently, in single file, oppressed by the gloom and by the absolute stillness of the land, broken only now and again by the faint rumbling, as of thunder, far away or drum beats in some hollow of the hills. Down from their hiding place they went, and then, turning south, they steered as straight a course as Gollum could find, across a long broken slope that leaned up towards the mountains. Presently, not far ahead, looming up like a black wall, they saw a belt of trees. As they drew nearer, they became aware that these were of vast size, very ancient, it seemed, and still towering high, though their tops were gaunt and broken, as if tempest and lightning blast had swept across them, but had failed to kill them or to shake their fathomless roots.
"The crossroads, yes," whispered Gollum, the first words that had been spoken since they left their hiding place. "We must go that way."
Turning eastward now, he led them up the slope, and then suddenly there it was before them, the southward road, winding its way about the outer feet of the mountains, until presently it plunged into the great ring of trees.
"This is the only way," whispered Gollum. "No paths beyond the road, no paths. We must go to the crossroads, but make haste. Be silent."
As furtively as scouts within the campment of their enemies, they crept down onto the road, and stole along its westward edge under the stony bank, grey as the stones themselves, and soft-footed as hunting cats. At length they reached the trees, and found that they stood in a great roofless ring, open in the middle to the sombre sky, and the spaces between their immense boles were like the great dark arches of some ruined hall. In the very centre four ways met. Behind them lay the road to the Morannon. Before them it ran out again upon its long journey south. To their right the road from old Osgiliath came climbing up, and crossing, passed out eastward into darkness. The fourth way, the road they were to take. Standing there for a moment filled with dread, Frodo became aware that a light was shining. He saw it glowing on Sam's face beside him. Turning towards it, he saw, beyond an arch of boughs, the road to Osgiliath running almost as straight as a stretched ribbon down, down into the west. There, far away, beyond sad Gondor, now overwhelmed in shade, the sun was sinking, finding at last the hem of the great slow-rolling pall of cloud, and falling in an ominous fire towards the yet unsullied sea. The brief glow fell upon a huge sitting figure, still and solemn as the great stone kings of Argonath. The years had gnawed it, and violent hands had maimed it. Its head was gone, and in its place was set in mockery a round rough-hewn stone, rudely painted by savage hands in the likeness of a grinning face, with one large red eye in the midst of its forehead. Upon its knees and mighty chair, and all about the pedestal, were idle scrawls mixed with the foul symbols that the maggot folk of Mordor used. Suddenly, caught by the level beams, Frodo saw the old king's head. It was lying rolled away by the roadside. "Look, Sam," he cried, startled into speech. "Look! The king has got a crown again!" The eyes were hollow, and the carven beard was broken, but about the high stern forehead there was a coronal of silver and gold. A trailing plant with flowers like small white stars had bound itself across the brows as if in reverence for the fallen king, and in the crevices of his stony hair yellow stonecrop gleamed.
"They cannot conquer forever," said Frodo,
and then suddenly the brief glimpse was gone. The sun dipped and vanished, and, as if at the shuttering of a lamp, black night fell. Chapter 8 The Stairs of Kirithungol. Gollum was tugging at Frodo's cloak and hissing with fear and impatience.
"We must go," he said. "We mustn't stand here. Make haste."
Reluctantly, Frodo turned his back on the west and followed as his guide led him out into the darkness of the east. They left the ring of trees and crept along the road towards the mountains. This road, too, ran straight for a while, but soon it began to bend away southwards until it came right under the great shoulder of rock that they had seen from the distance. Black and forbidding it loomed above them, darker than the dark sky behind. Crawling under its shadow the road went on, and rounding it sprang east again and began to climb steeply. Frodo and Sam were plodding along with heavy hearts, no longer able to care greatly about their peril. Frodo's head was bowed. His burden was dragging him down again. As soon as the great crossroads had been passed, the weight of it, almost forgotten in Ithilien, had begun to grow once more. Now, feeling the way become steep before his feet, he looked wearily up, and then he saw it, even as Gollum had said that he would. The city of the Ringwraiths. He cowered against the stony bank. A long tilted valley, a deep gulf of shadow, ran back far into the mountains. Upon the further side, some way within the valley's arms, high on a rocky seat upon the black knees of the Ephelduath, stood the walls and tower of Minas Morgul. All was dark about it, earth and sky, but it was lit with light. Not the imprisoned moonlight welling through the marbled walls of Minas Ithil long ago, tower of the moon, fair and radiant in the hollow of the hills. Paler indeed than the moon ailing in some slow eclipse was the light of it now, wavering and blowing like a noisome exhalation of decay, a corpse light, a light that illuminated nothing. In the walls and tower windows showed, like countless black holes looking inward into emptiness. But the topmost course of the tower revolved slowly, first one way and then another, a huge ghostly head leering into the night. For a moment the three companions stood there, shrinking, staring up with unwilling eyes. Gollum was the first to recover. Again he pulled at their cloaks urgently, but he spoke no word. Almost he dragged them forward. Every step was reluctant, and time seemed to slow its pace, so that between the raising of a foot and the setting of it down, minutes of loathing passed. So they came slowly to the white bridge. Here the road, gleaming faintly, passed over the stream in the midst of the valley, and went on, winding deviously up towards the city's gate, a black mouth opening in the outer circle of the northward walls. Wide flats lay on either bank, shadowy meads filled with pale white flowers. Luminous these were, too, beautiful and yet horrible of shape, like the demented forms in an uneasy dream, and they gave forth a faint sickening charnel smell. An odour of rottenness filled the air. From mead to mead the bridge sprang. Figures stood there at its head, carven with cunning in forms human and bestial, but all corrupt and loathsome. The water flowing beneath was silent, and it steamed, but the vapour that rose from it, curling and twisting about the bridge, was deadly cold. Frodo felt his senses reeling and his mind darkening. Then suddenly, as if some force were at work other than his own will, he began to hurry, tottering forward, his groping hands held out, his head lolling from side to side. Both Sam and Gollum ran after him. Sam caught his master in his arms, as he stumbled and almost fell, right on the threshold of the bridge.
"Not that way, not that way,"
whispered Gollum, but the breath between his teeth seemed to tear the heavy stillness like a whistle, and he cowered to the ground in terror. "Hold up, Mr. Frodo," muttered Sam in Frodo's ear. "Come back, not that way. Gollum says not, and for once I agree with him." Frodo passed his hand over his brow and wrenched his eyes away from the city on the hill. The luminous tower fascinated him, and he fought the desire that was on him to run up the gleaming road towards its gate. At last, with an effort, he turned back, and as he did so, he felt the ring resisting him, dragging at the chain about his neck, and his eyes, too, as he looked away, seemed for the moment to have been blinded. The darkness before him was impenetrable. Gollum, crawling on the ground like a frightened animal, was already vanishing into the gloom. Sam, supporting and guiding his stumbling master, followed after him as quickly as he could. Not far from the near bank of the stream, there was a gap in the stone wall beside the road. Through this they passed, and Sam saw that they were on a narrow path that gleamed faintly at first, as the main road did, until climbing above the meads of deadly flowers, it faded and went dark, winding its crooked way up into the northern sides of the valley. Along this path the hobbits trudged, side by side, unable to see Gollum in front of them, except when he turned back to beckon them on. Then his eyes shone with a green-white light, reflecting the noisome Morgul sheen, perhaps, or kindled by some answering mood within. Of that deadly gleam and of the dark eye-holes Frodo and Sam were always conscious, ever glancing fearfully over their shoulders and ever dragging their eyes back to find the darkening path. Slowly they laboured on. As they rose above the stench and vapours of the poisonous stream, their breath became easier and their heads clearer. But now their limbs were deadly tired, as if they had walked all night under a burden, or had been swimming long against a heavy tide of water. At last they could go no further without a halt. Frodo stopped and sat down on a stone. They had now climbed up to the top of a great hump of bare rock. Ahead of them there was a bay in the valley side, and round the head of this the path went on, no more than a wide ledge with a chasm on the right. Across the sheer southward face of the mountain it crawled upwards, until it disappeared into the blackness above. "I must rest a while, Sam," whispered Frodo. "It's heavy on me, Sam, lad, very heavy. I wonder how far I can carry it. Anyway, I must rest before we venture on to that." He pointed to the narrow way ahead. "Shh, shh," hissed Gollum, hurrying back to them. "Shh." His fingers were on his lips, and he shook his head urgently. Tugging at Frodo's sleeve, he pointed towards the path. But Frodo would not move. "Not yet," he said. "Not yet." Weariness and more than weariness oppressed him. It seemed as if a heavy spell was laid on his mind and body. "I must rest," he muttered. At this Gollum's fear and agitation became so great that he spoke again, hissing behind his hand, as if to keep the sound from unseen listeners in the air.
"Not here, no. Not rest here, fools. Eyes can see us. When they come to the bridge, they will see us. Come away. Climb, climb, come."
"Come, Mr. Frodo," said Sam. "He's right again. We can't stay here."
"All right," said Frodo in a remote voice, as of one speaking half asleep. "I will try." Wearily he got to his feet. But it was too late. At that moment the rock quivered and trembled beneath them. The great rumbling noise, louder than ever before, rolled in the ground and echoed in the mountains. Then with searing suddenness there came a great red flash. Far beyond the eastern mountains it leapt into the sky and splashed the lowering clouds with crimson. In that valley of shadow and cold deathly light, it seemed unbearably violent and fierce. Peaks of stone and ridges like notched knives sprang out in staring black against the uprushing flame in Gorgoroth. Then came a great crack of thunder, and Minas Morgul answered. There was a flare of livid lightnings, forks of blue flame springing up from the tower and from the encircling hills into the sullen clouds. The earth groaned, and out of the city there came a cry, mingled with harsh high voices as of birds of prey, and the shrill neighing of horses wild with rage and fear. There came a rending screech, shivering, rising swiftly to a piercing pitch beyond the range of hearing. The hobbits wheeled round towards it, and cast themselves down, holding their hands upon their ears. As the terrible cry ended, falling back through a long, sickening wail to silence, Frodo slowly raised his head. Across the narrow valley, now almost on a level with his eyes, the walls of the evil city stood, and its cavernous gate, shaped like an open mouth with gleaming teeth, was gaping wide, and out of the gate an army came. All that host was clad in sable, dark as the night. Against the wan walls and the luminous pavement of the road, Frodo could see them, small black figures in rank upon rank, marching swiftly and silently, passing outwards in an endless stream. Before them went a great cavalry of horsemen, moving like ordered shadows, and at their head was one greater than all the rest, a rider, all black, save that on his hooded head he had a helm like a crown that flickered with a perilous light. Now he was drawing near the bridge below, and Frodo's staring eyes followed him, unable to wink or to withdraw. Surely there was the Lord of the Nine Riders returned to earth to lead his ghastly host to battle? Here, yes, here indeed was the haggard king whose cold hand had smitten down the ring-bearer with his deadly knife. The old wound throbbed with pain, and a great chill spread towards Frodo's heart. Even as these thoughts pierced him with dread and held him bound as with a spell, the rider halted suddenly, right before the entrance of the bridge, and behind him all the host stood still. There was a pause, a dead silence. Maybe it was the ring that called to the Wraith Lord, and for a moment he was troubled, sensing some other power within his valley. This way and that turned the dark head, helmed and crowned with fear, sweeping the shadows with its unseen eyes. Frodo waited, like a bird at the approach of a snake, unable to move. And as he waited, he felt, more urgent than ever before, the command that he should put on the ring. But great as the pressure was, he felt no inclination now to yield to it. He knew that the ring would only betray him, and that he had not, even if he put it on, the power to face the Morgul King. Not yet. There was no longer any answer to that command in his own will, dismayed by terror though it was, and he felt only the beating upon him of a great power from outside. It took his hand, and as Frodo watched with his mind, not willing it but in suspense, as if he looked on some old story far away, it moved the hand inch by inch towards the chain upon his neck. Then his own will stirred. Slowly it forced the hand back and set it to find another thing, a thing lying hidden near his breast. Cold and hard it seemed as his grip closed on it. The file of Galadriel, so long treasured and almost forgotten till that hour. As he touched it, for a while all thought of the ring was banished from his mind. He sighed and bent his head. At that moment the Wraith King turned and spurred his horse and rode across the bridge, and all his dark host followed him. Maybe the elven hoods defied his unseen eyes, and the mind of his small enemy, being strengthened, had turned aside his thought. But he was in haste. Already the hour had struck, and at his great master's bidding he must march with war into the west. Soon he had passed, like a shadow into shadow, down the winding road, and behind him still the black ranks crossed the bridge. So great an army had never issued from that vale since the days of Isildur's might. No host so fell and strong in arms had yet assailed the fords of Anduin, and yet it was but one, and not the greatest of the hosts, that Mordor now sent forth. Frodo stirred, and suddenly his heart went out to Faramir. The storm has burst at last, he thought. This great array of spears and swords is going to Osgiliath. Will Faramir get across in time? He guessed it. But did he know the hour? And who can now hold the fords when the King of the Nine Riders comes, and other armies will come? I'm too late. All is lost. I tarried on the way. All is lost. Even if my errand is performed, no one will ever know. There will be no one I can tell. It will be in vain. Overcome with weakness, he wept. And still the host of Morgul crossed the bridge. Then, at a great distance, as if it came out of memories of the Shire, some sunlit early morning, when the day called and doors were opening, he heard Sam's voice speaking. "Wake up, Mr. Frodo! Wake up!" had the voice added. "Your breakfast is ready." He would hardly have been surprised. Certainly Sam was urgent. "Wake up, Mr. Frodo! They're gone," he said. There was a dull clang. The gates of Minas Morgul had closed. The last rank of spears had vanished down the road. The tower still grinned across the valley, but the light was fading in it. The whole city was falling back into a dark, brooding shade and silence. Yet still it was filled with watchfulness. "Wake up, Mr. Frodo! They're gone! And we'd better go, too. There's something still alive in that place, something with eyes, or a seeing mind, if you take me. And the longer we stay in one spot, the sooner it will get on to us. Come on, Mr. Frodo!" Frodo raised his head, and then stood up. Despair had not left him, but the weakness had passed. He even smiled grimly, feeling now as clearly as a moment before he had felt the opposite, that what he had to do, if he could, and that whether Faramir or Aragorn or Elrond or Galadriel or Gandalf or anyone else ever knew about it, was beside the purpose. He took his staff in one hand and the phial in his other. When he saw that the clear light was already welling through his fingers, he thrust it into his bosom and held it against his heart. Then, turning from the city of Morgul, now no more than a grey glimmer across a dark gulf, he prepared to take the upward road. Gollum, it seemed, had crawled off along the ledge into the darkness beyond, when the gates of Minas Morgul opened, leaving the hobbits where they lay. He now came creeping back, his teeth chattering and his fingers snapping. "Foolish! Silly!" he hissed. "Make haste! They mustn't think danger has passed. It hasn't. Make haste!" They didn't answer, but they followed him on to the climbing ledge. It was little to the liking of either of them, not even after facing so many other perils, but it didn't last long. Soon the path reached a rounded angle where the mountainside swelled out again, and there it suddenly entered a narrow opening in the rock. They'd come to the first stair that Gollum had spoken of. The darkness was almost complete, and they could see nothing much beyond their hands' stretch. But Gollum's eyes shone pale, several feet above, as he turned back towards them.
"Careful," he whispered. "Steps. Lots of steps. Must be careful."
Care was certainly needed. Frodo and Sam at first felt easier, having now a wall on either side, but the stairway was almost as steep as a ladder, and as they climbed up and up, they became more and more aware of the long black fall behind them. And the steps were narrow, spaced unevenly, and often treacherous. They were worn and smooth at the edges, and some were broken, and some cracked as foot was set upon them. The hobbits struggled on, until at last they were clinging with desperate fingers to the steps ahead, and forcing their aching knees to bend and straighten. And ever as the stair cut its way deeper into the sheer mountain, the rocky walls rose higher and higher above their heads. At length, just as they felt that they could endure no more, they saw Gollum's eyes peering down at them again.
"We're up," he whispered. "First stairs passed. Clever hobbits to climb so high. Very clever hobbits. Just a few more little steps, and that's all. Yes."
Dizzy and very tired, Sam, and Frodo following him, crawled up the last step and sat down rubbing their legs and knees. They were in a deep, dark passage that seemed still to go up before them, though at a gentler slope and without steps. Gollum did not let them rest long.
"There's another stair still," he said. "Much longer stair. Rest when we get to the top of next stair, not yet."
Sam groaned. "Longer, did you say?" he asked.
"Yes, yes, longer," said Gollum. "But not so difficult. Hobbits have climbed the straight stair. Next comes the winding stair."
"And what after that?" said Sam.
"We shall see," said Gollum softly. "Oh, yes, we shall see."
"I thought you said there was a tunnel," said Sam. "Isn't there a tunnel or something to go through?"
"Oh, yes, there's a tunnel," said Gollum. "But hobbits can rest before they try that. If they get through that, they'll be nearly at the top. Very nearly, if they get through. Oh, yes."
Frodo shivered. The climb had made him sweat, but now he felt cold and clammy, and there was a chill draught in the dark passage, blowing down from the invisible heights above. He got up and shook himself. "Well, let's go on," he said. "This is no place to sit in." The passage seemed to go on for miles, and always the chill air flowed over them, rising as they went on to a bitter wind. The mountains seemed to be trying with their deadly breath to daunt them, to turn them back from the secrets of the high places, or to blow them away into the darkness behind. They only knew that they had come to the end, when suddenly they felt no wall at their right hand. They could see very little. Great black shapeless masses and deep grey shadows loomed above them and about them, but now and again a dull red light flickered up under the lowering clouds, and for a moment they were aware of tall peaks in front and on either side, like pillars holding up a vast, sagging roof. They seemed to have climbed up many hundreds of feet, onto a wide shelf. A cliff was on their left and a chasm on their right. Gollum led the way close under the cliff. For the present they were no longer climbing, but the ground was now more broken and dangerous in the dark, and there were blocks and lumps of fallen stone in the way. Their going was slow and cautious. How many hours had passed since they had entered the Morgul Vale, neither Sam nor Frodo could any longer guess. The night seemed endless. At length they were once more aware of a wall looming up, and once more a stairway opened before them. Again they halted, and again they began to climb. It was a long and weary ascent, but this stairway did not delve into the mountainside. Here the huge cliff face sloped backwards, and the path, like a snake, wound to and fro across it. At one point it crawled sideways, right to the edge of the dark chasm, and Frodo, glancing down, saw below him, as a vast deep pit, the great ravine at the head of the Morgul Valley. Down in its depths glimmered like a glow-worm thread the wraith road from the dead city to the Nameless Pass. He turned hastily away. Still on and up the stairway bent and crawled, until at last, with a final flight, short and straight, it climbed out again onto another level. The path had veered away from the main pass in the great ravine, and it now followed its own perilous course at the bottom of a lesser cleft among the higher regions of the Ephelduath. Dimly the hobbits could discern tall piers and jagged pinnacles of stone on either side, between which were great crevices and fissures blacker than the night, where forgotten winters had gnawed and carved the sunless stone. And now the red light in the sky seemed stronger, though they could not tell whether a dreadful morning were indeed coming to this place of shadow, or whether they saw only the flame of some great violence of Sauron in the torment of Gorgoroth beyond. Still far ahead, and still high above, Frodo, looking up, saw, as he guessed, the very crown of this bitter road. Against the sullen redness of the eastern sky, a cleft was outlined in the topmost ridge, narrow, deep cloven between two black shoulders, and on either shoulder was a horn of stone. He paused and looked more attentively. The horn upon the left was tall and slender, and in it burned a red light, or else the red light in the land beyond was shining through a hole. He saw now. It was a black tower poised above the outer pass. He touched Sam's arm and pointed.
"I don't like the look of that," said Sam. "So this secret way of yours is guarded after all," he growled, turning to Gollum. "As you knew all along, I suppose."
"Always are watched, yes," said Gollum. "Of course they are. But hobbits must try some way. This may be least watched. Perhaps they've all gone away to big battle, perhaps."
"Perhaps," grunted Sam. "Well, it seems a long way off, and a long way up before we get there, and there's still the tunnel. I think you ought to rest now, Mr. Frodo. I don't know what time of day or night it is, but we've kept going for hours and hours."
"Yes, we must rest," said Frodo. "Let us find some corner out of the wind and gather our strength for the last lap." For so he felt it to be. The terrors of the land beyond, and the deed to be done there, seemed remote, too far off yet to trouble him. All his mind was bent on getting through or over this impenetrable wall and guard. If once he could do that impossible thing, then somehow the errand would be accomplished, or so it seemed to him in that dark hour of weariness, still labouring in the stony shadows above Cadyth Ungol. In a dark crevice between two great piers of rock they sat down, Frodo and Sam a little way within, and Gollum crouched upon the ground near the opening. There the hobbits took what they expected would be their last meal before they went down into the nameless land, maybe the last meal they would ever eat together. Some of the food of Gondor they ate, and wafers of the waybread of the elves, and they drank a little. But of their water they were sparing, and took only enough to moisten their dry mouths.
"I wonder when we'll find water again," said Sam. "But I suppose even over there they drink. Orcs drink, don't they?"
"Yes, they drink," said Frodo. "But don't let us speak of that. Such drink is not for us."
"Then all the more need to fill our bottles," said Sam. "But there isn't any water up here. Not a sound or a trickle have I heard. And anyway, Faramir said we were not to drink any water in Morgul."
"No water flowing out of Imlad Morgul," were his words, said Frodo. "We are not in that valley now, and if we came out on a spring it would be flowing into it and not out of it."
"I wouldn't trust it," said Sam. "Not till I was dying of thirst. There's a wicked feeling about this place," he sniffed. "And a smell, I fancy. Do you notice it? A queer kind of smell. Stuffy. I don't like it."
"I don't like anything here at all," said Frodo. "Step or stone, breath or bone, earth, air and water all seem accursed. But so our path is laid."
"Yes, that's so," said Sam. "And we shouldn't be here at all if we'd known more about it before we started. But I suppose it's often that way. The brave things and the old tales and songs, Mr. Frodo. Adventurers, as I used to call them. I used to think that they were things the wonderful folk of the stories went out and looked for because they wanted them, because they were exciting and life was a bit dull, a kind of sport, as you might say. But that's not the way of it with the tales that really mattered, or the ones that stay in the mind. Folk seem to have been just landed in them, usually. Their paths were laid that way, as you put it. But I expect they had lots of chances, like us, of turning back. Only they didn't. And if they had, we shouldn't know, because they'd have been forgotten. We hear about those as just went on, and not all to a good end, mind you. At least not to what folk inside a story, and not outside it, call a good end. You know, coming home and finding things all right, though not quite the same, like old Mr. Bilbo. But those aren't always the best tales to hear, though they may be the best tales to get landed in. I wonder what sort of a tale we've fallen into."
"I wonder," said Frodo, "but I don't know. And that's the way of a real tale. Take any one that you're fond of. You may know or guess what kind of a tale it is, happy ending or sad ending, but the people in it don't know. And you don't want them to."
"No, sir, of course not." "Beren, now.
He never thought he was going to get that Silmaril from the Iron Crown in Thangorodrim, and yet he did, and that was a worse place and a blacker danger than ours. But that's a long tale, of course, and goes on past the happiness and into grief and beyond it. And the Silmaril went on, and came to Iarendil. And why, sir, I never thought of that before. We've got, you've got, some of the light of it in that star glass that the lady gave you. Why, to think of it, we're in the same tale still. It's going on. Don't the great tales never end? No, they never end as tales, said Frodo. But the people in them come and go when their part's ended. Our part will end later, or sooner. And then we can have some rest and some sleep, said Sam. He laughed grimly. And I mean just that, Mr. Frodo. I mean plain ordinary rest and sleep, and waking up to a morning's work in the garden. I'm afraid that's all I'm hoping for all the time. All the big important plans are not for my sort. Still, I wonder if we shall ever be put into songs or tales. We're in one, of course. But I mean, put into words, you know, told by the fireside, or read out of a great big book with red and black letters, years and years afterwards. And people will say, let's hear about Frodo and the Ring. And they'll say, yes, that's one of my favourite stories. Frodo was very brave, wasn't he, Dad?
Yes, my boy, the famousest of the hobbits, and that's saying a lot.
It's saying a lot too much, said Frodo, and he laughed, a long, clear laugh from his heart. Such a sound had not been heard in those places since Sauron came to Middle-earth. To Sam, suddenly, it seemed as if all the stones were listening and the tall rocks leaning over them. But Frodo did not heed them. He laughed again. "Why, Sam," he said, "to hear you somehow makes me as merry as if the story was already written. But you left out one of the chief characters, Samwise the Stout-hearted. I want to hear more about Sam, Dad. Why didn't they put in more of his talk, Dad? That's what I like. It makes me laugh. And Frodo wouldn't have got far without Sam, would he, Dad?"
"Now, Mr. Frodo," said Sam, "you shouldn't make fun. I was serious."
"So was I," said Frodo, "and so I am. We're going on a bit too fast. You and I, Sam, are still stuck in the worst places of the story. And it is all too likely that some will say at this point, 'Shut the book now, Dad. We don't want to read any more.'"
"Maybe," said Sam, "but I wouldn't be one to say that. Things done and over and made into part of the great tales are different. Why, even Gollum might be good in a tale, better than he is to have by you anyway. And he used to like tales himself once, by his own account. I wonder if he thinks he's the hero or the villain." "Gollum," he called, "would you like to be the hero? Now where has he got to again?" There was no sign of him at the mouth of their shelter, nor in the shadows near. He had refused their food, though he had, as usual, accepted a mouthful of water, and then he had seemed to curl up for a sleep. They'd supposed that one, at any rate, of his objects in his long absence the day before, had been to hunt for food to his own liking, and now he had evidently slipped off again while they talked. But what for this time?
"I don't like his sneaking off without saying," said Sam. "And least of all now. He can't be looking for food up here, not unless there's some kind of rock he fancies. Why, there isn't even a bit of moss."
"It's no good worrying about him now," said Frodo. "We couldn't have got so far, not even within sight of the pass, without him, and so we'll have to put up with his ways. If his faults, his faults."
"All the same, I'd rather have him under my eye," said Sam. "All the more so, if his faults. Do you remember he never would say if this pass was guarded or no? And now we see a tower there, and it may be deserted, and it may not. Do you think he's gone to fetch them orcs, or whatever they are?"
"No, I don't think so," answered Frodo. "Even if he's up to some wickedness, and I suppose that's not unlikely, I don't think it's that. Not to fetch orcs, or any servant of the enemy. Why wait till now, and go through all the labour of the climb, and come so near the land he fears?
He could probably have betrayed us to Orcs many times since we met him. No, if it's anything, it will be some little private trick of his own that he thinks is quite secret. "Well, I suppose you're right, Mr. Frodo," said Sam.
"Not that it comforts me mightily.
I don't make no mistake. I don't doubt he'd hand me over to Orcs as gladly as kiss his hand. But I was forgetting. He's precious. No, I suppose the whole time it's been the precious for poor Smeagol. That's the one idea in all his little schemes, if he has any. But how bringing us up here will help him in that is more than I can guess."
"Very likely he can't guess himself," said Frodo. "And I don't think he's got just one plain scheme in his muddled head. I think he really is in part trying to save the precious from the enemy as long as he can, for that would be the last disaster for himself, too, if the enemy got it. And in the other part, perhaps, he's just biding his time and waiting on chance."
"Yes, Slinker and Stinker, as I've said before," said Sam. "But the nearer they get to the enemy's land, the more like Stinker Slinker will get. Mark my words, if ever we get to the pass, he won't let us really take the precious thing over the border without making some kind of trouble."
"We haven't got there yet," said Frodo.
"No, but we'd better keep our eyes skinned till we do. If we're caught napping, Stinker will come out on top pretty quick. Not but what it would be safe for us to have a wink now, master. Safe, if you lay close to me. I'd be dearly glad to see you have a sleep. I'd keep watch over you, and anyway, if you lay near, with my arm round you, no one could come pouring you without your Sam knowing it."
"Sleep," said Frodo, and sighed, as if out of a desert he had seen a mirage of cool green. "Yes, even here I could sleep."
"Sleep then, master. Lay your head in my lap."
And so Gollum found them hours later, when he returned, crawling and creeping down the path out of the gloom ahead. Sam sat propped against the stone, his head dropping sideways and his breathing heavy. In his lap lay Frodo's head, drowned deep in sleep. Upon his white forehead lay one of Sam's brown hands, and the other lay softly upon his master's breast. Peace was in both their faces. Gollum looked at them. A strange expression passed over his lean, hungry face. The gleam faded from his eyes, and they went dim and grey, old and tired. A spasm of pain seemed to twist him, and he turned away, peering back up towards the pass, shaking his head as if engaged in some interior debate. Then he came back, and slowly putting out a trembling hand, very cautiously he touched Frodo's knee, but almost the touch was a caress. For a fleeting moment, could one of the sleepers have seen it, they would have thought that they beheld an old, weary hobbit, shrunken by the years that had carried him far beyond his time, beyond friends and kin, and the fields and streams of youth, an old, starved, pitiable thing. But at that touch, Frodo stirred and cried out softly in his sleep, and immediately Sam was wide awake. The first thing he saw was Gollum, pawing at master, as he thought. "Hey, you," he said roughly, "what are you up to?"
"Nothing, nothing," said Gollum softly. "Nice, master."
"I dare say," said Sam. "But where have you been to, sneaking off and sneaking back, you old villain?" Gollum withdrew himself, and a green glint flickered under his heavy lids. Almost spider-like he looked now, crouched back on his bent limbs, with his protruding eyes. The fleeting moment had passed beyond recall.
"Sneaking, sneaking," he hissed. "Hobbits always so polite, yes. Oh, nice, hobbits. Smeagol brings them up secret ways that nobody else could find. Tired he is. Thirsty he is, yes, thirsty. And he guides them, and he searches for paths, and they say, sneak, sneak. Very nice, friends. Oh, yes, my precious, very nice."
Sam felt a bit remorseful, though not more trustful. "Sorry," he said. "I'm sorry, but you startled me out of my sleep. And I shouldn't have been sleeping, and that made me a bit sharp. But Mr. Frodo, he's that tired. I asked him to have a wink, and, well, that's how it is. Sorry. But where have you been to?"
"Sneaking," said Gollum, and the green glint did not leave his eyes.
"Oh, very well," said Sam. "Have it your own way. I don't suppose it's so far from the truth. And now we'd better all be sneaking along together. What's the time? Is it today or tomorrow?"
"It's tomorrow," said Gollum.
"Or this was tomorrow when hobbits went to sleep.
Very foolish, very dangerous, if poor Smeagol wasn't sneaking about to watch."
"I think we shall get tired of that word soon," said Sam. "But never mind. I'll wake Master up." Gently he smoothed the hair back from Frodo's brow, and bending down, spoke softly to him. "Wake up, Mr. Frodo, wake up." Frodo stirred and opened his eyes and smiled, seeing Sam's face bending over him. "Calling me early, aren't you, Sam?" he said. "It's dark still." "Yes, it's always dark here," said Sam. "But Gollum's come back, Mr. Frodo, and he says it's tomorrow, so we must be walking on, the last lap." Frodo drew a deep breath and sat up.
"The last lap," he said.
"Hello, Smeagol. Found any food? Have you had any rest?"
"No food, no rest, nothing for Smeagol," said Gollum. "He's a sneak."
Sam clicked his tongue, but restrained himself. "Don't take names to yourself, Smeagol," said Frodo. "It's unwise, whether they are true or false."
"Smeagol has to take what's given him," answered Gollum. "He was given that name by kind Master Samwise, the hobbit that knows so much."
Frodo looked at Sam.
"Yes, sir," he said. "I did use the word, waking up out of my sleep sudden and all, and finding him at hand. I said I was sorry, but I soon shan't be."
"Come, let it pass then," said Frodo. "But now we seem to have come to the point, you and I, Smeagol. Tell me, can we find the rest of the way by ourselves? We're in sight of the pass, of a way in, and if we can find it now, then I suppose our agreement can be said to be over. You've done what you promised, and you're free. Free to go back to food and rest, wherever you wish to go, except to servants of the enemy. And one day I may reward you, I or those that remember me."
"No, no, not yet," Gollum whined. "Oh, no, they can't find the way themselves, can they? Oh, no, indeed. There's the tunnel coming. Smeagol must go on. No rest, no food, not yet."
Chapter 9 Shelob's Lair. It may indeed have been daytime now, as Gollum said, but the hobbits could see little difference, unless, perhaps, the heavy sky above was less utterly black, more like a great roof of smoke, while instead of the darkness of deep night, which lingered still in cracks and holes, a grey blurring shadow shrouded the stony world about them. They passed on, Gollum in front and the hobbits now side by side, up the long ravine between the piers and columns of torn and weathered rock, standing like huge, unshapen statues on either hand. There was no sound. Somewhere ahead, a mile or so, perhaps, was a great grey wall, a last huge, upthrusting mass of mountain stone. Darker it loomed, and steadily it rose as they approached, until it towered up high above them, shutting out the view of all that lay beyond. Deep shadow lay before its feet. Sam sniffed the air.
"Huh, that smell," he said. "It's getting stronger and stronger."
Presently they were under the shadow, and there in the midst of it they saw the opening of a cave.
"This is the way in," said Gollum softly. "This is the entrance to the tunnel."
He did not speak its name. Torech Ungol, Shelob's Lair. Out of it came a stench, not the sickly odour of decay in the meads of Morgul, but a foul reek, as if filth unnameable were piled and hoarded in the dark within.
"Is this the only way, Smeagol?" said Frodo.
"Yes, yes," he answered. "Yes, we must go this way now."
"You mean to say you've been through this hole?" said Sam. "Phew! But perhaps you don't mind bad smells." Gollum's eyes glinted.
"He doesn't know what we minds, does he, precious? No, he doesn't. But Smeagol can bear things. Yes, he's been through. Oh, yes, right through. It's the only way."
"And what makes the smell, I wonder?" said Sam. "It's like, well, I wouldn't like to say. Some beastly hole of the orcs, I'll warrant, with 100 years of their filth in it." "Well," said Frodo, "orcs or no, if it's the only way, we must take it." Drawing a deep breath, they passed inside. In a few steps they were in utter and impenetrable dark. Not since the lightless passages of Moria had Frodo or Sam known such darkness, and if possible, here it was deeper and denser. There were airs moving, and echoes, and a sense of space. Here the air was still, stagnant, heavy, and sound fell dead. They walked, as it were, in a black vapour wrought of veritable darkness itself that, as it was breathed, brought blindness not only to the eyes but to the mind, so that even the memory of colours and of forms and of any light faded out of thought. Night always had been, and always would be, and night was all. But for a while they could still feel, and indeed the senses of their feet and fingers at first seemed sharpened almost painfully. The walls felt, to their surprise, smooth, and the floor, save for a step now and again, was straight and even, going ever up at the same stiff slope. The tunnel was high and wide, so wide that, though the hobbits walked abreast, only touching the side walls with their outstretched hands, they were separated, cut off alone in the darkness. Gollum had gone in first, and seemed to be only a few steps ahead. While they were still able to give heed to such things, they could hear his breath hissing and gasping just in front of them. But after a time their senses became duller. Both touch and hearing seemed to grow numb, and they kept on, groping, walking, on and on, mainly by the force of the will with which they had entered, will to go through and desire to come at last to the high gate beyond. Before they had gone very far, perhaps, but time and distance soon passed out of his reckoning. Sam, on the right, feeling the wall, was aware that there was an opening at the side. For a moment he caught a faint breath of some air less heavy, and then they passed it. "There's more than one passage here," he whispered with an effort. It seemed hard to make his breath give any sound. "It's as orc-like a place as ever there could be." After that, first he on the right, and then Frodo on the left, passed 3 or 4 such openings, some wider, some smaller, but there was as yet no doubt of the main way, for it was straight, and did not turn, and still went steadily up. But how long was it? How much more of this would they have to endure, or could they endure? The breathlessness of the air was growing as they climbed, and now they seemed often in the blind dark to sense some resistance thicker than the foul air. As they thrust forward, they felt things brush against their heads, or against their hands, long tentacles, or hanging growths, perhaps. They could not tell what they were, and still the stench grew. It grew until almost it seemed to them that smell was the only clear sense left to them, and that was for their torment. 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, how many had they passed in this lightless hole? Hours, days, weeks, rather. Sam left the tunnel side and shrank towards Frodo, and their hands met and clasped, and so together they still went on. At length Frodo, groping along the left-hand wall, came suddenly to a void. Almost he fell sideways into the emptiness. Here was some opening in the rock, far wider than any they had yet passed. and out of it came a reek so foul, and a sense of lurking malice so intense, that Frodo reeled. And at that moment Sam too lurched and fell forwards. Fighting off both the sickness and the fear, Frodo gripped Sam's hand.
"Ugh!" he said in a hoarse breath without voice. "It all comes from here, the stench and the peril. Now for it, quick!"
Calling up his remaining strength and resolution, he dragged Sam to his feet and forced his own limbs to move. Sam stumbled beside him. One step, two steps, three steps, at last six steps. Maybe they had passed the dreadful unseen opening, but whether that was so or not, suddenly it was easier to move, as if some hostile will for the moment had released them. They struggled on, still hand in hand. But almost at once they came to a new difficulty. The tunnel forked, or so it seemed, and in the dark they could not tell which was the wider way or which kept nearer to the straight. Which should they take, the left or the right? They knew of nothing to guide them, yet a false choice would almost certainly be fatal.
"Which way is Gollum gone?" panted Sam. "And why didn't he wait?"
"Smeagol!" said Frodo, trying to call. "Smeagol!"
But his voice croaked, and the name fell dead almost as it left his lips. There was no answer, not an echo, not even a tremor of the air.
"He's really gone this time, I fancy," muttered Sam. "I guess this is just exactly where he meant to bring us. Gollum, if ever I lay hands on you again, you'll be sorry for it."
Presently, groping and fumbling in the dark, they found that the opening on the left was blocked. Either it was a blind, or else some great stone had fallen in the passage.
"This can't be the way," Frodo whispered. "Right or wrong, we must take the other." "And quick," Sam panted. "There's something worse than Gollum about. I can feel something looking at us."
They had not gone more than a few yards when from behind them came a sound, startling and horrible in the heavy padded silence, a gurgling, bubbling noise, and a long, venomous hiss. They wheeled round, but nothing could be seen. Still as stones they stood, staring, waiting for they did not know what.
"It's a trap," said Sam,
and he laid his hold upon the hilt of his sword, and as he did so he thought of the darkness of the barrow whence it came.
"I wish old Tom was near us now," he thought.
Then, as he stood, darkness about him and a blackness of despair and anger in his heart, it seemed to him that he saw a light in his mind, almost unbearably bright at first, as a sun-ray to the eyes of one long hidden in a windowless pit. Then the light became colour, green, gold, silver, white, far off, as in a little picture drawn by elven fingers. He saw the Lady Galadriel standing on the grass in Lorien, and gifts were in her hands. "And you, Ring-bearer," he heard her say, remote but clear, "for you I have prepared this." The bubbling hiss drew nearer, and there was a creaking as of some great jointed thing that moved with slow purpose in the dark. A reek came on before it.
"Master! Master!" cried Sam,
and the life and urgency came back into his voice.
"The lady's gift, the star-glass! A light to you in dark places, she said it was to be, the star-glass."
"The star-glass?" muttered Frodo, as one answering out of sleep, hardly comprehending. "Why, yes. Why had I forgotten it? A light when all other lights go out.
And now, indeed, light alone can help us."
Slowly his hand went to his bosom, and slowly he held aloft the phial of Galadriel. For a moment it glimmered, faint as a rising star struggling in heavy earthward mists. And then as its power waxed, and hope grew in Frodo's mind, it began to burn, and kindled to a silver flame, a minute heart of dazzling light, as though Earendil had himself come down from the high sunset paths with the last Silmaril upon his brow. The darkness receded from it until it seemed to shine in the centre of a globe of airy crystal, and the hand that held it sparkled with white fire. Frodo gazed in wonder at this marvellous gift that he had so long carried, not guessing its full worth and potency. Seldom had he remembered it on the road, until they came to Morgul Vale, and never had he used it for fear of its revealing light. Aya Earendil Eleniol Ancalima, he cried, and knew not what he had spoken. For it seemed that another voice spoke through his, clear, untroubled by the foul air of the pit. But other potencies there are in Middle-earth, powers of night, and they are old and strong. And she that walked in the darkness had heard the elves cry that cry far back in the deeps of time, and she had not heeded it, and it did not daunt her now. Even as Frodo spoke, he felt a great malice bent upon him, and a deadly regard considering him. Not far down the tunnel, between them and the opening where they had reeled and stumbled, he was aware of eyes growing visible, two great clusters of many-windowed eyes. The coming menace was unmasked at last. The radiance of the star-glass was broken, and thrown back from their thousand facets, but behind the glitter a pale deadly fire began steadily to glow within, a flame kindled in some deep pit of evil thought. Monstrous and abominable eyes they were, bestial and yet filled with purpose and with hideous delight, gloating over their prey trapped beyond all hope of escape. Frodo and Sam, horror-stricken, began slowly to back away, their own gaze held by the dreadful stare of those baleful eyes. But as they backed, so the eyes advanced. Frodo's hand wavered, and slowly the file drooped. Then suddenly, released from the holding spell, to run a little while in vain panic for the amusement of the eyes, they both turned and fled together. But even as they ran, Frodo looked back and saw with terror that at once the eyes came leaping up behind. The stench of death was like a cloud about him. "Stand! Stand!" he cried desperately. "Running is no use." Slowly the eyes crept nearer. "Galadriel!" he called, and gathering his courage, he lifted up the file once more. The eyes halted. For a moment their regard relaxed, as if some hint of doubt troubled them. Then Frodo's heart flamed within him, and without thinking what he did, whether it was folly or despair or courage, he took the phial in his left hand, and with his right hand drew his sword. Sting flashed out, and the sharp elven blade sparkled in the silver light, but at its edges a blue fire flicked. Then, holding the star aloft and the bright sword advanced, Frodo, Hobbit of the Shire, walked steadily down to meet the eyes. They wavered. Doubt came into them as the light approached. One by one they dimmed, and slowly they drew back. No brightness so deadly had ever afflicted them before. From sun and moon and star they had been safe underground, but now a star had descended into the very earth. Still it approached, and the eyes began to quail. One by one they all went dark. They turned away, and a great bulk, beyond the light's reach, heaved its huge shadow in between. They were gone.
This ends Disc 13.